We're getting up to speed on the impeachment inquiry into President Trump here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're looking at the work of House committees and subpoenas, including the president's private lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. President Trump made a racially loaded reference on Twitter this week, calling the inquiry a lynching, and he gave a combative briefing to reporters at the White House.
I think they want to impeach me because it's the only way they're going to win. They've got nothing. All they have is a phone call that was perfect. All they have is a whistleblower who's disappeared. Where is he? He's gone.
How do you feel about private depositions unfolding behind closed doors? Do you want public hearings on the president's dealings with Ukraine? We're at 800-642-1234. Kim Whaley is a law professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, where she teaches and writes on the constitutional separation of powers, administrative law, and civil procedure. She's a legal analyst for CBS News, and her new book is called How to Read the Constitution and Why. Kim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Untangle for us, if you will, how government attorneys are not like the kind of lawyers in private practice whose job basically it is to defend their clients' best interests.
Yeah, so I've been in and out of government in my practice as well as teaching. And for government lawyers, the question is, what do we do that is best for the United States of America as a whole? So inside the Justice Department, when I was there, and then we have to make a decision about whether to file a certain brief in a case, for example, the question wasn't just how do we win this at all costs, which I think when I say at all costs, so long as it's within the boundaries of ethics and the law, that's kind of the posture that is taken in private practice for lawyers. The objective is to get what the outcome the client wants. For government lawyers, it's different. It's if we file this motion, if we win this case, what does that mean for the rule of law? What does that mean for the next case and the next case? How will that affect policy for Americans? It's very, very different. Government lawyers understand their client is the public, the American public, not any particular person in office in any given time, because those people change with each administration.
And help us understand a little bit, if you will, the work of the Justice Department and guidelines that prevent even federal prosecutors from charging a sitting president with a crime. Because, you know, outside of the impeachment inquiry, we have a Manhattan district attorney pursuing President Trump's tax returns. And that is in office enforcing state laws, but not bound by Justice Department guidelines.
Yes, great question. So we, of course, have two systems. There's a federal system that is headed, the criminal justice system that's headed ultimately by the President of the United States under Attorney General Barr. Then we have state U.S. attorneys or U.S. District attorneys that implement state law, state criminal law. And then within the Justice Department, we're hearing a lot, for example, about the Southern District of New York. Those are federal prosecutors. They all answer to the president. So we have the federal system. We have the state system. Under the federal system, there is an internal guidance document that was produced essentially during the Whitewater investigation or after that, where I worked on that, by President Clinton's Justice Department. And the question President Clinton gave to his Justice Department is, listen, as a matter of policy, is it constitutional for the Justice Department to prosecute sitting presidents? And that Justice Department came up with an internal memo that said, no, we believe it's not constitutional. That's not a law. It's not in a statute. It's not in the Constitution. It's essentially kind of like a part of their personnel manual. These are the kinds of cases that we are going to allow our prosecutors to prosecute. So within the Justice Department, the current Attorney General could amend that memo any day, change the internal policy for prosecutors in the government, in the federal government, and open investigations and prosecutions into the president. At the state level, because they are individual sovereign states, they're not bound by that internal policy for DOJ prosecutors. And so we are seeing, the New York State attorney general make different decisions regarding potentially how that criminal process is unfolding, because they're not bound by that internal decision. Now, if that question ever went to the United States Supreme Court and we had a court ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court that, say, a sitting president could be indicted or could not be indicted, that would bind the entire United States. But prior to that, the law is open. The law is not settled in that regard.
We're talking with Kim Whaley. She's a law professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. You can join in. We're talking about the role of attorneys in government and the impeachment inquiry. Have you ever been subpoenaed in a case? Did you follow the request? Are you a judge? How important is it for witnesses to fulfill a subpoena request? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Kim, yesterday, longtime U.S. diplomat William Taylor testified he served as ambassador to Ukraine. And we have since learned that Taylor told lawmakers that President Trump orchestrated a parallel foreign policy for Ukraine. There's this 15-page written testimony and then his hours of answers that are not publicly known behind closed doors. So how does the written document work with oral statements, and how then did it get leaked to the media outlets, or, you know, in the hands of the media?
I mean, I believe that was something, and I could be wrong on this, that the witness himself made public.
Okay.
Even grand jury witnesses aren't bound by any secrecy themselves. They're allowed to talk to outside people if they choose to. It's important to keep in mind here, as I mentioned, I worked on the Whitewater investigation, and I know there's a lot of questions about whether House Democrats are being fair to the president, are following procedures that are fair and open and transparent. In Whitewater, Ken Starr operated with a grand jury. A grand jury in the criminal justice process is secret. If you are a target of a grand jury investigation that could produce an indictment that could ultimately put you in jail, you don't get to go into the grand jury. You don't get to have your lawyers cross-examine grand jury witnesses. You don't get to know who else the prosecutors are being subpoenaing or asking to testify before the grand jury. All of that is in secret, and it can produce, you could lose your liberty as a subject. Here we've got a president who could lose his job, so the stakes, frankly, for him personally are lower. Because we don't have a special prosecutor or an independent counsel doing the investigative spade work on Ukraine, and like Ken Starr did, and giving all those facts to Congress, Congress is having to act like prosecutors in the first place. That's why this is done in a kind of methodical, quiet, behind-the-scenes way, so they can get the facts out. And then presumably there will be public hearings on their findings. There certainly would be for a trial in the Senate. But they're having to do the work of gathering the facts in a methodical way that allows them to unfold ultimately for the American people. So that's a really important distinction here.
And on a timeline that originally had been really short timeline, and now we're hearing that this process could take quite a while.
Well, think about it. I mean, the Starr investigation was 6 or 7 years. Robert Mueller's investigation with a team of professional prosecutors was 18 months. This is, you know, as you kind of pull the thread of the sweater with respect to Ukraine, presumably, like any good investigator, they're going to find more people they need to talk to, more documents they need to look at. If this is done properly and fairly to the president, frankly, it should take a long time because it's a complicated, I mean, the basic scenario is clear, but the levels of potential involvement by people in and out of the government could take some time to unravel and to understand.
We're talking with University of Baltimore law professor Kim Whaley as we look at the legal process of the impeachment inquiry. Do you believe President Trump's phone call with the Ukraine president is an impeachable offense, or do you disagree with this inquiry? What are your thoughts? What questions do you have about the Justice Department's role in this? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Uh-huh. House Republicans have heavily criticized the way Democrats are going about this impeachment inquiry into President Trump. We're getting an update on the investigation, the closed-door depositions, the subpoenas. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This week, Republicans' efforts to censure House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff for his handling of the inquiry, that failed. President Trump is calling this inquiry illegitimate because the House did not formally vote to authorize one. So what do you make of the proceedings? What questions do you have about the role of the Justice Department and the role of the president's private attorneys? We're at 800-642-1234. University of Baltimore law professor Kim Whaley stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Willem joining us from Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Good morning. A vote in the House is not required for this impeachment, so that is a false argument by the president. And frankly, I don't see how any person could possibly give the president any credibility. I think the New York Times is up to, I don't know, you know, how many untruths the president has spoken. He lies as easily as he breathes. And his statement about this impeachment process being like a lynching is one of the most offensive things I've ever heard a U.S. president say. I'm 68 years old. I don't think I've ever heard a president make a comment like that. It's all about him, like everything is always about him. But it's not illegal, and no person is above the law, not even the president of the United States. Because if you put the president of the United States above the law, or like some people assert, that, like Nixon said, that if the president does it, it can't be illegal. What's the difference between that and the divine right of kings?
Well, Willem, I'm going to jump in here, and Willem has certainly been keeping close tabs on this. But, you know, he's saying that he doesn't feel the president's due process rights have been violated, Kim.
Yeah, I mean, Willem makes a lot of, I think, really important macro points about this. I talk about this in the book. This isn't so much about President Trump himself. It's about the office of the presidency. If we allow the belts and suspenders of the office of the presidency to expand to the point where there's no oversight, which is essentially this president's point of view, his White House counsel's point of view, then impeachment itself is improper, which of course it isn't. It's in the Constitution. Then regardless of political parties, we're in an environment where we have whoever's in that office can do what they want, regardless of the law, regardless of the limits. And the framers of the Constitution understood that when that happens, regular people get hurt. And the office itself has to stay accountable for individual rights in this country to be protected, to avoid arbitrary decision-making by government officials against regular people. So the stakes, regardless of where you are in the political spectrum, the stakes for the integrity of our democracy, for our children who can't vote in November 2020, some of them, are absolutely, could not be higher in my view as a scholar.
Let's bring in Katrina now in Grand Chute. Hi, Katrina.
Good morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a strong protest against the so-called inquiry, which is basically a fishing expedition. Our president was elected, and the Democrats are trying to bring him down by slander and innuendo, and nothing. Their facts are not there. And every person in the United States has the right to face their accuser.
So, Katrina, you feel that the whistleblower should be revealed. Kim Whaley, go ahead.
Okay, a couple things. One is the president, if this goes to trial in the Senate, he will have the opportunity through his lawyers to confront whatever witnesses are going to testify. So that's the phase where, even if I can make an argument due process doesn't technically apply, but to the extent to which he gets the right to face accusers, it will be in a Senate trial, and Mitch McConnell has indicated he'll go forward with that. So he will get his fair process. With respect to the whistleblower personally, The whistleblower statute is preceded the Constitution itself. It's as old as the hills when it comes to sort of American law. And the idea is that if people inside government can let us know, the rest of us know a potential wrongdoing, we can keep government honest. And that goes across political parties. At this point, the whistleblower, him or herself, is irrelevant. The question is firsthand knowledge of what happened. And I understand Katrina's frustration and concern with the process. But here we do have the president's own statements in the summary of the phone call. We have his chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, publicly conceding some critical facts. We have lifelong diplomats that have worked under Democratic and Republican presidents confirming the basic facts. So the question really isn't what happened. The question is what should be done about what happened, if anything. And that's a political judgment for the Congress.
Talking with Kim Whaley, a law professor at the University of Baltimore, we're looking at the impeachment inquiry and how the testimonies work before House panels. Kim, we were talking recently with Democratic Representative Ron Kind of Wisconsin, and Republicans have complained about having limited access to these closed-door testimonies. And here is Congressman Kind talking about this on our show.
I think it's appropriate because as a former special prosecutor, you do want to interview these witnesses in isolation so that other witnesses can't coordinate their stories.
What do you make of that? Having these testimonies in isolation so other witnesses can't coordinate their stories.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, you know, best practices for investigators and prosecutors. Imagine the alternative scenario. We saw it, for example, with the confirmation process of Brett Kavanaugh, where you have public sort of testimony with the news media, with members of Congress making sort of political speeches potentially in their questions. And it's really difficult for the witness to get the facts out and for there to be a measured, thoughtful judgment. This is a grave decision. This is really important for the American populace and for the future of democracy, for this to be done right. And as I said, best practices for an investigation, which is what Congress is doing right now, is to keep these things quiet and behind closed doors. That's what happens in the grand jury. If you're called to testify in the grand jury, you cannot bring your lawyer into the grand jury. So it's a bit awkward because we have Congress doing it. But in terms of how to get the fairest record for a potential trial in the Senate, I agree with the congressman that this is best practices.
Well, let's back up a day or so as Republicans failed to force a vote on the House floor that would have censured House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff for his handling of the impeachment inquiry. Explain what that was about and what happened there.
Well, I mean, you know, I think that's less of concern sort of in the overall process. My understanding, it was a political judgment that Adam Schiff has kind of reframed some of the evidence in ways that wasn't arguably to some people entirely accurate. But again, the eye that we should have is on the ball of what the witnesses are actually saying and what the Congress decides to do with the information that it gathers. There is no constitutional requirement to actually have a vote to start the process. Andrew Johnson, there was no vote to start the process. I know there's an argument that there was one with Ken Starr and there was one with Jaworski. But again, those are different times. And as we saw with, for example, the nomination of Merrick Garland to the United States Supreme Court under Obama, the Senate, Mitch McConnell, refused to even bring that nominee to the floor. And I say that because whoever's in power in Congress has the authority to set the rules for how they proceed. And that's what's happening in the House right now.
How is completing this investigation, bear into our Constitution and the backbone of what we are here in the U.S.?
Okay, so imagine, and a prior caller mentioned sort of a monarchy. the framers and the revolutionaries did not want a monarchy anymore. They didn't want a king who could basically come into their house with a general warrant and rifle through their stuff for absolutely no reason. And so the idea was, we'll set up a structure, we'll set up a job description to make sure that whoever gets power is checked by someone else, that nobody gets ultimate power. So they broke the monarchy into three parts: the judicial branch, the executive branch, and the legislative branch. And the structure assumes that every branch gets their papers graded by the other two branches. You mentioned earlier the DOJ internal guidance saying you can't indict a sitting president. So imagine that a president sort of orders the murder of, and this obviously this isn't happening, but imagine the president orders the murder of every third person walking down the street in Milwaukee. That would be a problem to have a president with that kind of power or exercising that kind of power under DOJ guidelines. Couldn't prosecute that person federally. It has to go to Congress. If Congress doesn't exercise some oversight power, then we have a presidency, an office that can do whatever it wants. And that's really bad for the American people. The next president, even if you support this president, you might not support the next president, and you'd want limits on that person's power. And that's why this inquiry is so critical. Regardless of whether he gets impeached and removed from office or gets reelected, it's absolutely vital that Congress protect its prerogative of oversight.
Kim, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Kate.
Kim Whaley is a law professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Her latest book is called How to Read the Constitution and Why. Coming up, vampires, zombies, and werewolves in our midst, and we look at age-old monster myths and what they have to do with science. That's right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin Public Radio has a new podcast out. It's called Derailed. It's about how high-speed rail almost came to Wisconsin. And the third episode dropped today. This one looks at the backlash against the high-speed rail plan. You can find Derailed wherever you get your podcasts or at WPR.org. Right now, we're talking about the biological explanations for monster myths. How did stories about vampires or other supernatural-type monsters shape what you feared growing up? Are you wondering about a scientific explanation for these seemingly life forms? We're at 800-642-1234. Bill Sullivan is a professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine, where he studies genetics and infectious disease. And this time of year, he loves to lecture on the possible biological explanations for our most famous monster myths. Bill, welcome to the Ideas Network. Welcome back.
Good morning, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you've been looking at how science can explain some of our oldest monster myths, and your research was inspired by exorcism. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I study infectious disease, specifically brain parasites, here at the IU School of Medicine. So I've long been fascinated how these pathogens can change host behavior, sometimes in ways that mimic what we see in our so-called monsters. Now, I was a kid of the 70s, so I grew up with films like The Exorcist. And one of them, it was one of the most scariest films that I recall, because it really is one of these examples where you're truly robbed of your agency. You're robbed of the person who you thought you were. And we know today that this can be caused by any sort of brain damage. Sometimes there are genetic disorders and people develop neuropsychoses like schizophrenia, multiple personality disorder. And then there's brain parasites, which can also induce bizarre changes in behavior that can sometimes initiate a cascade of neurological problems that could mimic what we see in demonic possession.
There's also autoimmune diseases that could be happening.
That's exactly right. So there's a modern story that took place in the early 2000s. There was this budding journalist named Susanna Kahalan who started acting strangely for no obvious reason. She was growing confused, missing work, losing balance. And then it started to progress into hallucinations, speaking in tongues, even lashing out and biting people. Just really bizarre behavior. And something like demonic possession crosses the mind because no medication was working. Doctors didn't know what was going on. Millions of dollars were being spent on tests. No answers were coming out. But fortunately, her family got the help of a neurologist instead of an exorcist. And he eventually discovered that she had a new type of autoimmune disease where her body was making antibodies that were attacking her brain.
Wow. And so they were attacking her brain and therefore causing all of these really different types of reactions outwardly, physically in the body.
That's right. The official name for the disease is a mouthful. It's called anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis. And basically, her body was manufacturing antibodies that were jamming one neuron from talking to the next. So it was plugging up her synapses. And the good news, it does have a happy ending in this case, because if you treat the patient with immune suppressive drugs, it calms the immune system down and the symptoms usually reverse. So Kahalan wrote a memoir about this, a pretty famous story called Brain on Fire, if people are interested in reading more. But it just makes you shiver to think that there could have been hundreds, maybe thousands of people like this throughout history who were ostracized, imprisoned, or even burned at the stake because of what we know today as an autoimmune brain disease.
And so as you look at unusual behaviors and you connect the dots to the science that you study, how did your research inform the way you understand monsters? What to you does it mean to be a monster?
To be a monster, by definition, is to deviate from the norm. The word is derived from a Latin root that means warning. So there is usually something unusual about the appearance or behavior of a plant or an animal. That's what we consider to be a monster. And we don't know if these differences are threatening. Our brain is a conservative organ. It's engineered to keep us alive, so it usually plays things safe. And whenever it encounters something that is unusual, it hesitates to predict what that means. So it usually errs on the side of caution, and this can be for better or worse. Sometimes it can keep you alive, but at other times it can cause you to bully or ignore or dismiss or be afraid of someone or something that truly isn't, cause for alarm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're talking with Bill Sullivan. He's an infectious disease specialist who's been researching possible explanations behind some of our oldest monster myths. And you can join in. Why do you think we hold so close to these monster stories centuries later? Do you think we tend to categorize things we don't understand as monsters? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Bill, let's take a look here at the legend of the vampire. Tell us about what might have been the inspiration behind the blood-sucking monster.
So the vampire myth came out of the 1600s. It's a Slavic term for bloodsucker. And an academic several years ago drew some interesting parallels between the rabies virus and what we see in vampire folklore. Some of these parallels include biting. So rabies is transmitted by turning the host into a ferocious beast that salivates at the mouth where the viral particles accumulate. And then they bite in order to transmit the disease. So that's something in common with rabies as well as vampires. There's also hydrophobia. This is a fear of water. Now, most people don't know that individuals with rabies, their throat muscles are paralyzed. And this is what causes all the saliva to accumulate in the mouth. It causes the foaming at the mouth. And that's important for viral transmission. But as we also know, vampires are afraid of holy water. So there's a connection there. And then finally, there's a connection with bats. Vampires transform into bats and vice versa. And rabies, one of the most common vehicles of transmission, is the bat.
So, and then when they're exposed to light, their skin will turn red and blister. What's happening there?
Oh, this is another disease called porphyria. That kind of sounds like a lost Def Leppard album, but that is actually that's actually a kind of rare blood disorder, and it's genetic in origin. porphyria is independent from rabies, so this is something different, but it has also been implicated in fueling vampire folklore. So what's happening here, real briefly, is that individuals with this blood disorder can't make heme. Heme is the critical component of hemoglobin in your blood, and it takes the oxygen to the various parts of your body. Heme is made from porphyrin, and if the body can't convert porphyrin into heme, the porphyrin accumulates, and this is a toxic, light-activated chemical. So these individuals end up being pale. They have red receding gums that emphasize our canines, and the porphyrin chemicals in the skin will burn their flesh, they'll blister and peel if exposed to light, much like you see in the Hollywood films where if a vampire sees sunlight, he begins to melt.
Is this curable or reversible?
Well, that's what makes it even more bizarre. In the old days, this was treated by drinking blood. So again, you have a very clear parallel to vampire folklore. Because when these individuals would drink blood, it's presumed that some of the heme in that blood will survive the digestion process and get into their body and remedy their condition to a small degree. Today, it is still treated in a similar fashion, but through blood transfusions. Unfortunately, there's no cure for the genetic ailment unless you're looking forward to things like CRISPR and gene editing. That may in the future be a possible cure for this.
So just regular blood transfusions would at least keep it in check?
That's right. It replenishes the blood so you don't get anemic. The paleness goes away. You get a little more energy back because your muscles are getting the oxygen they need. But you still have to be aware of being in the sun because those porphyrin chemicals are at much higher levels in a patient like that than a normal person.
Well, getting back for a moment to rabies and some other things here, the werewolf, though, is quite hairy, and people with a hair condition don't exactly display any behavioral changes. So what should we know there?
Rabies actually has been connected to werewolves. You're right about the hair connection. That might be something else. So werewolves, this is a very old legend. It goes all the way back into Greek mythology, maybe earlier with the legend of Lycaon. So he angered Zeus. So Zeus turned him into a wolf. So that's where we initially see the idea of humans transforming into wolves. And it has led to this clinical condition called clinical lycanthropy, which is individuals who have a neurological issue where they actually believe they can transform into a wolf, and then they sometimes emulate the wolf's behavior. So that's something that grew out of the Greek myth. What you're referring to with respect to the hair is a condition called congenital hypertrichosis lanuginosa. Now, that's a mouthful, so we'll just call it CHL. This, again, is a heritable genetic condition where there is nothing wrong with these people, but they do grow a lot of hair, and in places where it normally doesn't grow, including the cheeks, the forehead, on the ears. So they certainly would not behave like a werewolf, but if they got rabies, then you got a powerful combination that could have certainly fueled that legend.
Bill Sullivan is with us as we look at monster myths, the science behind them. He studies genetics and infectious disease at Indiana University School of Medicine. Where do you see the science in the supernatural? Do you think we tend to categorize things we don't understand as monsters? Where have you seen that most clearly? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're at the intersection of monster mythology and science here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have microbiologist Bill Sullivan here who studies infectious disease, and he's here to tame our fears. As we've been talking about, rabies was once described as a disease that strips you of your humanity and leaves only the beast, which is what you think about when you size up your average werewolf and get some Hollywood in the mix. Do you think supernatural forces exist? How do you define monster? Does science help inform your ideas about vampires and zombies? Calling all zombies, join in 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. And Bill Sullivan stays with us from Indiana University School of Medicine. Bill, let's look at zombies here, these flesh-eating corpses walking around. We've seen them in so often on the big screen in movies. How did they come about? Where was their myth born?
Zombies are one of my favorite. And if you want to see some, stop by my house one morning, Monday morning. I'll show you a couple of zombies.
I have some roaming around as well.
Yeah. Hopefully they're not the flesh-eating kind, though.
I wouldn't put it past them.
So zombies have evolved over time. So the whole aggressive and flesh-eating variety is relatively new. Zombies actually have their origins in Haitian voodoo. This is an ancient religion from Haiti, and it sadly got influenced by the slave trade that was going on when this religion started to take shape. It was a combination of that with some African religions as well. What it involves is losing your sense of self and becoming a mental slave. So Haitian zombies clearly aren't dead, but what would happen is a sorcerer, which was called a Bokor, would administer something called zombie dust, which was found to later contain powerful neurotoxins that can cause paralysis and make the victim look dead. But as those toxins wear off, they would come back to life. So they would believe that they were resurrected. And then they would be in debt to the Bokor and serve as his slave for the rest of their life, or the Bokor would destroy their soul forever. So that was the predicament and where we got the idea for these zombies. Modern zombies do have a much more ferocious and biting characteristics associated with them. And that is much more consistent with what we see with a viral infection like rabies, would have been much more common in the past. So there's a possible connection there. There's also a lot of real world zombies, and this is getting into my wheelhouse and what we do in the laboratory. These are parasites and pathogens that can alter the brain chemistry or the immune system of a host and result in a change in behavior. We already mentioned the rabies virus, but some of the other more popular ones are the zombie ant fungus. I mean, it's got zombie right in the name. So it turns these ants into zombies. There's these worms that can invade crickets and cause them to jump into water, which is a suicidal thing for a cricket to do. But the worm makes the cricket do that because it needs to get to the water in order to reproduce. And then there's the so-called cat parasite called toxoplasma, which we study in my lab. When it gets into mice and rats, it causes them to lose their fear of cats, because cats are where the parasite needs to go in order to complete the sexual stage of its life cycle.
And that's also a reason why women who are pregnant shouldn't be cleaning the litter box.
That's right. They're not going to get infected with toxoplasma and throw themselves into a lion cage or anything like that. But toxoplasma is associated, it's correlated with causing certain neuropsychoses like schizophrenia or rage disorder and some other conditions like that. But the real danger for pregnant women, if she becomes infected with this parasite for the first time during the pregnancy, it can lead to abortion or congenital birth defects.
We're talking with Bill Sullivan, who studies genetics and infectious disease at Indiana University in Indianapolis. And this month, he's giving talks about the possible biological explanations for our most famous monster myths. And monsters aside, how else do you like to use science to debunk old beliefs? Or do you still think supernatural forces really do exist? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Maddie from De Pere called in, couldn't stay with us, but wants to know about the history of ghosts. For those who've seen ghosts, when did that tradition start? Is there any scientific or science connection to ghosts?
So that's a very interesting question. So ghosts prey upon our fear of death, and it you know, whether you believe in them or not, the myth is pretty simple. There is some sort of afterlife that our souls go to upon death, and ghosts are kind of trapped in between. They can't get to that afterworld, so they continue to stay here and haunt the living and give producers of horror films plenty of fodder for their material to scare audiences. Of course, being a scientist, I'm highly skeptical. I don't have any belief in the supernatural, and I can give you a good case study as to why. But ghosts have probably been around as long as we realize we are mortal. And then we started, you know, our uncomfortable brain starts to design scenarios where, well, maybe we stick around after death. You know, that's a very comforting and enticing thing to want to believe. And then, of course, if you do want to believe in an afterworld, it just kind of creates the possibility that ghosts could still be stuck here and not able to make that transition, not able to go into the light, as we saw in the Poltergeist movie.
Yeah, and ghosts do ignite some fear in people. Are we humans predisposed to feel fear? What can science tell us about fear?
Yeah, well, fear is a very useful emotion. It's kept us alive for millennia as a species. Fear basically alerts us to danger, and there is a complex biochemical cascade that is initiated in the body when we feel afraid. So fear is completely biological in origin. There's nothing mysterious about it. Neurosurgeons can elicit fear just by poking certain parts of the brain during brain surgery. People will inexplicably experience fear just by pricking the right part of the brain. So what happens when our brain perceives something that might be dangerous or threatening? This neurological cascade occurs where the flight or fight response kicks in. We get this boost of adrenaline. Our heart starts beating faster. We get these chemicals coursing through our veins that keep us more alert. So we're on edge, we're sharp, we're ready for action. And that can be a very healthy thing if it's a short-term experience. If the fear is not shakable, like in PTSD or other phobias, then you run into a clinical problem. And this is a failure of the body to clear these fear chemicals that are coursing through our veins. So it is a great emotion to have. It keeps us alive. It can be fun to experience. It can be motivating. But it can also lead to a downward spiral if we can't get it under control.
Well, don't leave us on a cliffhanger here about supernatural powers. What is your take?
Yeah, my take is that, as history has taught us, monsters are aberrations that need to be understood, not necessarily feared. And I believe science illuminates that darkness. You know, we can cower in fear, like citizens of the New England vampire panic who thought their town was being besieged by vampires when in fact it was just tuberculosis. They would have had no way of knowing that if it wasn't for the scientist Robert Koch, who at the same time in Germany was isolating the bacteria that caused TB. So we can cower in fear, or we can roll up our sleeves and figure out what in the world's going on.
You would much prefer to be in your lab, I can tell.
That's what they pay me to do.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us, and happy Halloween. Premature, but happy Halloween.
Same to you, Kate. It's always a pleasure to be on. Thank you very much.
Bill Sullivan is a professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis, where he studies genetics and infectious disease. He is the author of the new book, Pleased to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.